From Cafe, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
How are you, Ann?
I'm good. How you doing?
So I almost forgot that I needed to log in so we could tape this thing because I was going to watch Hamilton film one more time.
Yeah, you can.
I signed up for that Disney Plus so fast. So we were going to watch it as a family. Couldn't watch it on Friday because people were doing things. We're going to watch it Saturday evening, and then I cheated.
And no.
On Friday evening at like midnight, I couldn't resist. So I watched
yourself?
Yeah.
Without your family?
Yes. Yes, but then I...
You know what we call that in our family? Cheetah, the fastest animal alive.
Look, it's not like I was stealing a penguin, all right? It's you know.
That's a violation of the rules, though. I always love, like, we have friends.
I only watched a couple of things. Like, I watched a couple of the things, and then I rewatched.
That's your story, and you're sticking to it. Yes.
I rewatched the entire 2 hours and 40 minutes the next evening with everyone.
And did everyone know you'd watched it the night before?
Yeah. I fessed up right away.
Okay, good.
I think I might have tweeted about it. Like, I can't do anything in secret anymore because I end up tweeting about it.
It's true. Your kids just need to look on Twitter and they'll know, oh, Dad.
They all follow me now. Like, they didn't used to, but now they do follow me.
And no cursing. You gotta keep it clean.
I mostly don't.
You generally do anyway. Yeah. Not really an issue. Yes.
So that was a highlight. That was good. Have you seen it yet?
Speaking of Hamilton, we saw it in the theaters. We haven't watched it yet, but we will watch it. And we're really excited to watch it and to see it. And I know, like, sort of we were doing other stuff on Friday night. And like Twitter was exploding with the film and the sort of hashtag. So we're really excited to watch it. Do you know who else is up on Hamilton, by the way?
Who?
Justice Kagan.
Oh, yeah. No, she makes a reference. We discussed this in my interview for Stay Tuned that hasn't come out yet. She makes a reference to Hamilton and also Veep.
Yes. Yes, in the Faithless Electors case. And we could talk about that really quickly if you want to, because it, of course, relates to Hamilton. Which is just a strange thing to say that we've segued from Hamilton as a film on Disney Plus to Justice Kagan's opinion for the Supreme Court, a unanimous opinion that basically said that states can require people who are promised to uphold essentially a vote for a candidate in a state. So, for example, in Washington state, Hillary Clinton was the Democratic nominee in 2016. Three people didn't want to vote for Clinton. They were promised to vote for her. They were people vote for electors that then go on to the Electoral College to vote for the actual president. The state voted for Clinton. All those electors were then promised to her. Three people didn't want to do that. And so they wrote in Colin Powell, and the Supreme Court basically said, no, states are allowed to enforce. Like, you basically say the electors are promised to a certain candidate and states are allowed to say you have to vote for those people. You can't just go freelance. So it all sort of comes full circle. To me, the takeaway, I don't know if you have any takeaways on it, but to me, the takeaway is that it's really important for this election coming up that, you know, if a state votes for a candidate, that those votes get counted for that candidate, and that there isn't the sort of freelancing of people who, you know, and if you think about it, it would disenfranchise all of us, right? If I vote for a candidate thinking that there'll be someone who goes to the Electoral College voting for that candidate, and then they go turn around and vote for someone else, it feels unfair.
Yeah, I think that all makes sense. And I think the fact that it was unanimous, you know, tells you what they thought of the argument. Can we focus on the more frivolous aspect of it for another second?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think judges should be given leeway to have some fun in their opinions and make jokes and make cultural references and that sort of thing? Because they do it from time to time. I think it's okay.
Rare.
I think some prudish jurisprudential people think that people should always be serious in a written opinion.
Well, you know, if you're not going to be serious, this was the opinion to let loose a little because, you know, there are three people who were writing in Colin Powell in Colorado. I think there were three people who challenged the Colorado law requiring people to vote for the candidate. And only one of them, I think, wanted to vote for someone else. The other two ultimately voted for Clinton. They were promised to Clinton. And so, you know, there was very little harm here in the bigger picture. It was more of sort of a legal question of, you know, can states enforce this? And I think the violation in Washington state was something like $1,000 per person. There was a fine. I don't love fines generally, but like it's pretty... In the bigger picture, like it's not a major criminal case where somebody's liberty is at stake. It's not the future of like political contribution. So I think if you're ever going to do it, now's the time. But yeah, you know, I will say like I was reading it and I was like, huh, So I definitely had a reaction. I think it's fine for them to do it once in a while. It's just, you and I have probably read now thousands of cases. Like, it just, it's so rare that you see it that I was like, oh, that's interesting.
There was an opinion once, I can't remember if it was district court or circuit court, where the matter at issue, I think it had something to do with copyright, but it had something to do with the movies. It was about the movie industry. And as you're reading, you realize that the judge had sort of surreptitiously slipped into the text and into the footnotes in the language of the opinion titles of movies. And so it became sort of a game to remember that. And you had to figure out how many different titles you could find. So it became kind of like an exercise. So as we were saying earlier, one good thing that happened this weekend was we watched Hamilton, the film. One bad thing that happened is as colleges around the country are figuring out what their plans are for the fall, and there was hope against hope that there'd be some return to normalcy. There is not for a lot of people going back to their universities. And in my case, my daughter got the official news yesterday that she will not be going back to college at all, not in the fall or the spring. And she's a rising sophomore. And that's kind of upsetting. It's a pretty aggressive action that her school is taking. But it leads to this other issue that has come up that affects some of her friends also. And that is ICE is essentially saying that with respect to foreign students who have been given student visas, if their schools are planning all online learning, they have to get the hell out of the country. You saw that?
Yeah, I saw it. And you know, it's hard for me to understand why they're doing this and why they're doing it in the way they're doing it. And so Immigration and Customs Enforcement has long had this rule that basically says if you can't get a visa to come to the U.S. just to take online classes. And so, for example, you couldn't just come to the U.S. to go to the University of Phoenix online. The idea being like,
if that makes sense, right?
Yeah, it makes sense, right? If you're basically physically want to be in the U.S., there should be a reason for it. And so they've always required that for vocational, they've always required that it be really 100% in person. And so with academic, they've required that it be like at least a certain percentage of the amount of time that you're taking classes. And so in March, when COVID-19 hit and the schools just immediately hit pause and went online, they put a pause on that rule. They basically said, we're going to put it on hold. We're going to allow folks to stay here. Frankly, it really creates issues. There are students who could not travel to their home countries. There are travel restrictions. And there are reasons also that if you're a student, think about your daughter, like she just found out yesterday that she can't go back in the fall. If you're a student from another country, if you go home, you may not be able to come back, right, in the fall. So a lot of people just wanted to stay put and try, hopefully, to get back to the classroom. So they hit pause on that rule. And I just assumed, as I think a lot of people did, that that would last during this very unusual and rare period of time that the rule never imagined would be the case. And instead, yesterday, ICE came out and basically said, if you're a foreign student, like, so for example, a foreign student at your daughter's school could not stay in the United States, would have to essentially leave because they, or find another basis to get a visa, like an internship or a job for which they were permitted. But that's very difficult to do.
Or to transfer to a place that's not going online, which is exactly. Too late to do in almost every instance.
Yes, exactly. It is late. If they'd said this in March, like, look, we'll do this for this semester, but starting in the fall, people have to be sitting in classes. And you know, the fix that a lot of people are talking about is if you are at a hybrid school. So we teach at NYU Law. NYU Law has said they'll be hybrid in the fall, meaning students will get to choose whether they're remote or in person, and not all classes will be able to be offered in person, but some will be. And so if a student is enrolled in a program like that, they could be, as long as they go, I think, to a physical class, and I don't know the exact number of classes they have to attend in a semester, but it is not every class. They don't have to be in a situation every day where they might feel concerned about their health and safety. So there is a path for universities now to change course and say they're doing hybrid and then offer a couple of courses in person that would allow these students to stay. But it really just felt to me like, you know, unnecessary, really like not reading the moment in time, which is like the students are not seeking to stay in the U.S. to be online. They want to be in school. So it felt really unfair to me.
Especially when many of the colleges are making housing accommodations for some of those people. Like there are schools, including my daughter's, that are making an accommodation for people who are in special circumstances, like those international students, I believe, and allowing them to be on campus. And so when the school is being accommodating, I don't know why, other than the cruelty, it's an unnecessary thing that is part and parcel of an overall anti-immigration stance by the administration. I think they have the lawful ability to do this, and they have that pre-existing rule, but I think they're over-exercising their authority.
Just one other point, which is that colleges and universities are already hurting a lot because their budgets depend on students being enrolled and students being in housing. They own, you know, the housing properties. They budget for those properties to be rented and to have a full group of students. And so, you know, this is yet another way where you could see how it will hurt a university who's probably counting on having whatever group of foreign students they admit, they're counting on having those students there. And so, again, it feels last minute. It feels unfair to the students. It's not their fault that we're in the midst of a global pandemic. And it just feels like, you know, it's hard to think of what the point is other than to crack down on immigration and you know, it just feels to me like there's no reasonable basis for it. Again, I think it's lawful, but a lot of people were upset about it yesterday, and I think rightly so.
Look, this administration doesn't want to protect the dreamers. So if you have that situation, you can see that they're sort of seeking out every opportunity to stop people from coming into the United States, even people who are earning an education and might be future contributors to America. Doesn't make a lot of sense unless you understand what the whole sort of premise of the anti-immigration platform is that comes out of the head and mouth of Stephen Miller. Ordinarily, something like this would be decided, you know, at the agency level, maybe not even at the highest level of the agency. And that may be true here because they know the marching orders and they know the principles, the anti-immigration principles espoused by the White House. But I wouldn't be shocked if this is something that was Stephen Miller's own idea as he pores over these regulations and figures out ways to screw people who are trying to be here lawfully in the country and either learn or work.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking yesterday about one of the conversations we had about the border and what Trump has done at the border with people trying to enter the country. And I remember, you know, the conversation of like, why would they do that? And you said something of, you know, maybe the cruelty is the point. And I thought that yesterday when it's like, it's hard to see that there's a real immigration purpose, that there's, you know, they've already authorized people to come into the U.S. It feels to me impossible to argue that they're a risk to U.S. society. They're not taking jobs that Americans otherwise would have. Frankly, college enrollments are down, so they're not taking spots for others. Like, just, I can't think of a justification that people could argue that has any legitimacy in my mind.
Yeah. So there's another criminal case that has burst onto the scene. It's something that I think people have been wondering about for a while. People will remember Jeffrey Epstein and that saga that had a lot of twists and turns. And the case against him ended when he killed himself under weird and disturbing circumstances at the Metropolitan Correctional Center while he was awaiting trial in the Southern District of New York. But his associate, an associate by the name of Ghislaine Maxwell, was indicted by SDNY last week in a 6-count indictment. Press conference held by the new acting U.S. Attorney Audrey Strauss.
Today, we announce charges against Ghislaine Maxwell for helping Jeffrey Epstein sexually exploit and abuse multiple minor girls from the period of 1994 through 1997.
It's an interesting indictment. I guess there are questions as to why it took that long. Some of the conduct that's alleged there does not overlap with the conduct that had been alleged against Jeffrey Epstein. But maybe we should take a step back and discuss who this woman, Ghislaine Maxwell, is.
Yeah, so she's someone, and it's worth noting, this is almost a year to the day after Epstein was indicted in the Southern District. And just to go back, folks will remember that Jeffrey Epstein, he pled guilty in 2008 in Florida, and that plea was to soliciting a prostitute. And again, you know, we remember that there was a federal investigation, and that federal investigation was essentially for sex trafficking and other things. It was pushed aside by Alex Acosta. Essentially, instead, Epstein got a sweetheart deal. He got this plea in Florida state court. In 2009, there was a civil suit brought by one of Epstein's victims, and she said in that civil suit that she'd been sexually abused by both Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell when she had been 16. So Maxwell goes back to having been named in a suit back in 2009. Epstein, when he was charged last year, he was charged with sex trafficking minors. And that time period was related to 2002 to 2005. And the allegations were that he was sex trafficking girls as young as 14 to have sex with him. that basically was the sort of context that this comes up in. At the time when he was indicted, I think a lot of us were asking the question as to why she was not charged as well. And the reason why is that the allegations in the civil suit and that were also made publicly were essentially that Ghislaine Maxwell had been Epstein's girlfriend and then became, he described her in a Vanity Fair article as his best friend. And it was very clear that she was facilitating the young girls going back and forth between Florida, where Epstein had a place, and New York, where he lived as well. She was facilitating getting them to those locations and essentially setting up these massages that were sexual assaults of these young women. And so she was clearly identified as somebody who was part of the overall scheme. Which was, you know, a lot of times when you think about sex trafficking, someone is procuring the victims, someone is, you know, luring them in giving them money or compensation of some form. And so, you know, there was a lot, I think, of evidence in my mind, at least at the time, that would have warranted investigating Maxwell for sex trafficking as part of a conspiracy with Epstein.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that we'll get into some of the details of the particular charges. But something for people to remember is we have case after case where there's someone who is believed to be, based on public allegations and otherwise, a serial sex offender. You have Harvey Weinstein, you have Bill Cosby, you have others. At the end of the day, when charges are brought, if they are ever brought, they're most usually brought with respect to a small subset of those charges, because you can't have generalized allegations that someone has engaged in sexual misconduct. In the court of law, you have to have a specific victim, specific corroboration if the victim is going to testify about what that victim says and alleges, and, you know, other physical evidence if it's possible as well, which often is not when a lot of time has passed. And so even though it's the case that there's a lot of public allegation that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell engaged in this conduct over a course of years and with many, many, many victims, at the end of the day, at this moment, the charges against Ghislaine relate to three victims who are not identified by name but are identified generically, who probably are people who are going to testify at the trial and, you know, are the best evidence that the government has about particular misconduct.
And can we go to 2 points on that I think are worth noting? The first is that, to your point, which is exactly right, that it's not about generalized allegations. It's about specific conduct under a statute. So sex trafficking, you have to essentially prove that someone was compelled into a commercial sex act. So a sex act for which there's some form of compensation. So in thinking about someone like Maxwell or other enablers, and you can think about this whether it's in the context of Harvey Weinstein or Jeffrey Epstein or others, you have to prove that they shared the intent of the principal. If you charge them with profiting or somehow, you know, being a part of this overall sex trafficking organization, you have to prove that they knew about this organization, right? Or that they shared in the intent that Epstein had to sexually assault these young women. And so when you think about that, you can understand that it's not as straightforward as if a victim walks in and says, I was sexually assaulted by Jeffrey Epstein. That's not enough in order to convict someone like Maxwell. You need to have that victim walk in and be able to say, here are the things that Maxwell did. And you have to be able to prove the case against her based on that. So I think your point is well taken. There is some evidence, though, when you go back to this and to what she was actually charged with, there is some evidence, and it goes back to the 90s. And so the counts charged in this indictment that relate to these three victims are from 1994 to 1997. What's really interesting about that is it predates the sex trafficking statute, the Trafficking Victims Protection Act, which went into law in 2000. And so Epstein was charged with sex trafficking. So essentially, she's charged with the Mann Act, which is transporting someone across state lines for purposes of sexual assault. And she's charged with essentially enticing those women. But what's really important to understand is that those charges, which are before the human trafficking laws went into effect, they are charges in which there's one victim, there's specific allegations that Maxwell engaged in a sexual assault of a young woman along with Epstein. And that's powerful and important evidence, again, showing her actions. And so as we think about this, it's just really important to sort of put those pieces together when we think about why is she charged with the 1990 stuff and not the 2000 pieces.
So there are two other counts in the indictment as well that are counts of perjury, which can be a little bit easier to prove, but they're kind of interesting. They stem from a civil deposition that Ghislaine gave in April of 2016 that arose from a lawsuit against her based on some of these same allegations. And when you charge perjury or you charge making a false statement under 18 U.S.C. 1001, you have to plead with particularity in the indictment what the statements were that you're alleging were false and material. And in count five, they actually list the Q&A. And in the deposition, Ghislaine was asked, did Jeffrey Epstein have a scheme to recruit underage girls for sexual massages, if you know? By the way, that's never a good practice to say if you know. I don't know why people do that. Obviously, you only say it if you know. The answer was, from Ghislaine, I don't know what you're talking about. Question, list all the people under the age of 18 that you interacted with at any of Jeffrey's properties. Answer, I'm not aware of anybody that I interacted with other than obviously the plaintiff, who was 17 at this point. They allege that that's perjury. Then there's count six, which there's a little bit of a longer excerpt from the deposition, which just, you know, warning to some folks if you're listening with your kids. Question, were you aware of the presence of sex toys or devices used in sexual activities in Mr. Epstein's Palm Beach house? Answer, no, not that I recall. And then there's more questions about the sex toys or devices. And then she gets asked about other sexual activities of Mr. Epstein. And then the question is it your testimony that in the 1990s and 2000s, you were not aware that Mr. Epstein was having sexual activities with anyone other than yourself and the blonde and brunette on those few occasions when they were involved with you? Answer, that is my testimony. That is correct. Question, is it your testimony that you've never given anybody a massage? It's kind of a broad question.
That's a very, very broad question. Answer is equally broad. Yeah.
I have not given anyone a massage. Anyone. Question, you never gave Mr. Epstein a massage? Is that your testimony? Answer, that is my testimony. Then question, you never gave minor victim two a massage? Is your testimony? Answer, I never gave minor victim two a massage. So it's some detail.
And the fact that it's charged like that means that minor victim two will testify at a trial that, in fact, Maxwell did give her a massage. Yes.
Yeah, it's what it must mean. But also, we were talking about time frames. And yeah, the particular first four counts that relate to sex trafficking and enticement and coercion of a minor relate to a particular time period, 94 to 97. But you see, with respect to these charges of perjury, these falsehoods, the time frame for the activity that's being asked about is much broader than 94 to 97.
Yeah. The one thing I'd say, so there are a couple of points about the 94 to 97 charges. It's clear that they have witnesses, victims who will testify, and it's clear that there are some pretty specific allegations. It is older, though. So you're talking about things that happened 10 years before, you know, the sort of 2000, the allegations from the 2000s. You're also talking about laws that I'm not saying that they're hard to prove. I personally favor the human trafficking statutes, which basically say for victims under the age of 18, that if there's a commercial sex act, that the individuals involved and the people who profit or can be held liable for federal sex trafficking. So I think there's got to be a reason that they didn't charge it as sex trafficking. Either they intend to, or they're hoping to, or they're always looking for additional victims, or they've made a decision that their strongest case and the victims on which they can rely to prove that Maxwell was involved directly, the strongest case is from the 1990s. And so they've gone with that. What do you make of the arguments, Preet, that this relates to Berman being fired recently? Jeff Berman, who was the U.S. attorney until recently, and now his first assistant has taken over. And it's really less than 2 weeks later that these charges were filed.
Yeah, I take that as pure coincidence. I mean, when I was fired in March of 2017, there were some cases, including a very prominent one, that we were investigating with respect to the mayor of the city of New York, which was close to conclusion. And that's always going to be the case, right? There's always, in an office like SDNY, in the course of any given year, there are probably, you know, a dozen or more very significant cases. Any given time, there's going to be a significant case that's about to be announced or arrests about to be made. And so when someone leaves, there's always going to be some significant thing that happens shortly thereafter. And people are always going to say, well, maybe, you know, that's not a coincidence or some reason why the case wasn't brought before, and I just don't buy that. I mean, Audrey Strauss was handpicked by Jeffrey Berman. I'm sure they were on the same page with respect to how they were deciding to pursue various cases, and now is just the time.
Yeah, and in your case, I'm pretty sure that the president wouldn't have fired you to protect Bill de Blasio, the Democratic mayor of New York.
Right.
I'm just saying, that's just my view. What do you make, Preet, of the fact that this case is being handled as the Epstein case was in the public corruption unit, not in the human trafficking unit of the U.S. Attorney's Office?
I think that's, you know, somewhat significant. People have commented on it, and it could be for a number of reasons. It could be that as an initial matter, there were at least one or more targets or subjects of the investigation who were public figures. Maybe they were looking at the sweetheart deal that you were talking about between the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Southern District of Florida, led then by Alex Acosta, public official. And maybe they thought there were some irregularities there, and that's what they were looking at. Maybe they were looking at some other prominent public officials who seem to have been caught up in the sex trafficking, against whom charges have not been brought. But there are people, including a certain prince, that has been implicated in all of this. And so maybe they decided, because of the sensitivity of the matters and the possibility that there would be some investigation of or charges against someone who is a public figure, either here or somewhere else, that that's why the investigation was there. You know, it's not the first time that what looks like a sex trafficking operation was being investigated by the Public Corruption Unit in the Southern District. You may recall some years ago, and this was a giveaway at the time as well, that there was an investigation into a certain prostitution ring and escort service, whose name I'm now forgetting. And my good buddy, I think this is true, Boy Johnson, who was then the chief of the Public Corruption Unit, was sitting in the back of the courtroom when there was a presentment or an arraignment of a defendant in that sex trafficking case, and people wondered why that was. And then we all learned sometime later the reason that was the case is that one of the people caught up in that investigation was the then governor of the state of New York, Eliot Spitzer. They took his resignation, and then my predecessor, Mike Garcia, made the decision not to charge him. But look, that's an example of how you have this kind of a case with this kind of conduct being investigated by the Public Corruption Unit. I'm not saying that there's necessarily such a person, but that's a reasonable—
It's also a fair point that, like, if you had a group of lawyers who came in initially to do the public corruption aspect of it, why was he given a sweetheart deal in Florida? All those pieces, they would keep the case as a rule. You know, they might bring in someone with sex trafficking prosecution experience, but once the case is in a unit and they've gone down the road of a prosecution. Now, you mentioned Prince Andrew of England. I was sort of struck by the photographs of Ghislaine Maxwell sitting on the throne in England. It's a very interesting thing to see about, like, the extent of the power that Epstein had and the sort of access that they both had, and potentially the depth of what went on here. I mean, we don't know, but I don't want to sort of speculate, but it really, that's sort of jarring. What's also interesting to me is, I think the question a lot of folks are raising is, will she plead guilty and cooperate? Will she become a cooperator? And I think these are obviously serious charges. They carry sentences of up to 20 years in at least one instance. And so, but she is also not the principal. She will make arguments, I think, defenses that are other than the defenses, maybe similar to what Epstein has made. But I think she'll make defenses of, you know, I didn't know it was happening. I think that those will be, obviously, the U.S. Attorney's Office believes that they can defeat them. And it feels to me like they are setting this up to have victim testimony that, you know, she was involved directly. But what do you make of this possibility that she cooperates and provides evidence against other people? Yeah.
I think the presumption with respect to almost anybody who is charged, whether it's a drug conspiracy case or something like this, or public corruption, there's an open door policy on cooperation. And if it is the case that she is aware of other misconduct on the part of folks who are not currently chargeable, and she wants to get some lenience in her sentencing if she decides to plead guilty, yeah, she should come forward with that. And by the way, people should remember, it is not always the case that an arrested person necessarily can get cooperation only for disclosing information about other people who are involved in the same kind of misconduct that they were. I mean, if you go back and take a totally different kind of case that we've talked about in the past, the college admissions scandal, where all those prominent and wealthy parents were paying to have people take their kids' SATs or, you know, get into sports programs at various colleges. All those cases all around the country were made on the strength of one cooperating witness. And that cooperating witness, who I think came out of Massachusetts, was being investigated and was squeezed on a securities fraud investigation and said, hey, I had this information about this college admission scandal, and hence he became a cooperator. It is possible, given, you know, the circles in which Ghislaine Maxwell travels, that she has evidence of completely different kinds of crimes and other sorts of things that are going on in the part of prominent people or not prominent people. And that can be the basis of cooperation as well. So you never know. It's not necessarily the case that she has, like, a little black book that lists all the disgusting men who engaged in this underage sexual misconduct.
It's possible she does, right?
Yeah, but it's
possible she has other evidence of other crimes.
Yeah, the way we thought about it was, you get somebody and you have decent evidence against them, and the lawyer calls and says, is there any possibility of cooperation? And the response would always be, you know, what do you have? What do you got? And you never know what kinds of crazy things people have. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities. And, you know, you and I are in a difficult position outside of that place and not privy to the conversations to know what kind of information she has. And maybe she doesn't have any, or maybe she's not willing to provide any. And she thinks it's a winnable case because the charges are old and recollections can be attacked. But I think it's an uphill battle for her.
I agree. And I think that you can tell from the charges that at least with one victim, there are specific allegations related directly to her. And so I think some of the defenses that she would try to use if she were charged as part of this conspiracy, she is charged with conspiracy, but if it were just a conspiracy charge and there were no specific and direct allegations against her, you know, essentially getting these minors to Epstein in Florida and back and forth and herself sexually abusing one of the girls. I think if not for those specific allegations, it's a harder case for the government and she would have more of an ability to sort of say, I didn't know it was happening. I personally think that's defeatable as an argument. But again, the specific nature of the sort of allegations here make me think that the government has been careful to sort of have both.
And she has another potential defense. I think it's a weak defense and it's one that we talked about before there was any additional charge against an associate of Epstein's. And that is this weird deal we keep talking about in the Southern District of Florida included something that I've never seen. I don't know if you have ever seen. The deal purported to shield all other people who were involved with him. In other words, third parties could not be charged and they were immunized in connection with the plea deal that Jeffrey Epstein entered into. Now, usually you have an understanding between the government, the prosecutor's office, and the particular defendant who's pleading guilty. And you say, if you plead guilty to this, you will not be further prosecuted for stuff that's in connection with this thing that you're pleading guilty to. You don't get sort of blanket immunity for all sorts of other unknown and unnamed co-conspirators or enablers that you have. That agreement named four specific people. Ghislaine Maxwell was not one of them. So presumably her lawyers will try to make the argument that there was an agreement of immunity with respect to anybody who's involved with him. And that was done by United States Attorney's Office in the Southern District of Florida, which is part of the Department of Justice. And here you have another U.S. Attorney's Office. The Southern District of New York should be bound by that agreement. Most people think, and I agree, that that doesn't make a ton of sense as a legal matter, that that agreement with the Southern District of Florida binds only that United States Attorney's Office, especially if it's the case, and we think we talked about this before, especially if it's the case that that office didn't publicize the fact that there was this global deal with all the other U.S. attorney's offices. There have been times when I was the U.S. attorney that you get an email or you get a memo from the attorney general's office saying, hey, the U.S. attorney's office in Colorado is settling once and for all, you know, some big environmental case or some other, you know, some other action with a party. Please let us know if you have any pending investigations or if you object to that in any way. In that circumstance, which is very rare, but it happened, I guess there is some argument that every U.S. attorney's office in the department as a whole is barred from bringing a later case because you knew about the settlement and you knew about the arrangement and you had a chance to object. This didn't happen here as far as I can tell. And I don't think the legal argument is going to hold. I don't think it's an enforceable thing, especially since she wasn't named in that agreement either.
I agree. I think even if she was named, that legally it wouldn't be binding on the Southern District for all the reasons you just say. I've never seen anything like it. And I think you just can't imagine a world in which you would allow U.S. attorney's offices to bind one another without any knowledge or the approval of the department as a whole, that it would bind all these other offices. It's very strange. And so I agree with you. The fact that she's not named makes it even more implausible to me that she has a real argument. I suspect her lawyer may argue it because, I mean, they're going to have to think about how to sort of argue.
You argue everything. You don't leave an argument on the table.
Exactly. And one other thing I think we'll see, just to sort of front this for folks, is going back to Prince Andrew for a second. You know, there's an allegation that Maxwell set up an encounter for him with an underage girl in London. That's not charged in the indictment. And it probably is not charged because there are jurisdictional issues, right? You would have to prove that something was connected to the United States. What becomes interesting in my mind is the government often moves to get in something known as 404B evidence, other bad acts evidence. And so even if Maxwell isn't charged with other incidents that could have been criminal, the government can try to get in evidence of those. And so it's an interesting question to me here. And, you know, we saw this with the Weinstein case. you see it in a lot with Bill Cosby's case. There's other bad acts evidence that comes in, even though it's not charged as part of the indictment. And so I would expect to see some of that fight between the government and the defense counsel here. And potentially we'll see some of that, some other witnesses and victims come in at trial.
One other point I want to make about the possibility of cooperation, what often bears on that decision, and many people have made this point, but it's something that we took as an article of faith, right or wrong. If someone gets incarcerated pre-trial, in other words, does not make bail, that person often, you might imagine, engages in a process of deliberation that leans more heavily towards cooperation. People do not want to be locked up. And depending on what happens with her, that could affect her decision to cooperate or not cooperate. At the moment, we're recording this on Tuesday, July 7th. I think there is
hearing is Friday
the 10th.
That's right.
And yes. The judge, by the way, is Judge Allie Nathan, who's very smart and very deliberate, and I think.
I agree.
Yeah, we both know her.
We'll be thoughtful. Yes.
We'll be very thoughtful.
We'll be thoughtful on this.
And we'll be careful in this case, and is a good judge.
It's an interesting question, too, because I think one of the interesting questions with bail will also be, it appears, you know, the government has taken the position that she should not be given bail, that Maxwell should not get bail. She has 15 bank accounts totaling more than $20 million. She bought property in New Hampshire where she was placed under arrest by the FBI for over $1 million. That was done in the name of a limited liability corporation to conceal her identity. And so they're basically going to argue. She also has passports.
Plural. From passports, plural.
Exactly. France, the United Kingdom, and the United States. And so they're going to argue that, you know, she has a motive to flee. She has the opportunity because she has the funds and the ability to use these limited liability corporations to sort of conceal her movements. And she's got passports. So she has the ability to travel on these other passports or, you know, get a private jet or whatnot. And so I think, you know, that will be the argument that's made. She also, it's very interesting because what's not clear to me, and I'm sure the government has a sense of this, what's not clear to me is how much of her money comes from Epstein, although the townhouse that she owns in New York, which was purchased by a limited liability corporation, is 10 blocks from Epstein's townhouse. And so it appears, at least the sort of subtext, is that a lot of that money came from Epstein. And it will be the source of a lot of her funds. And so, you know, I think that there are going to be a lot of fascinating questions at play on Friday in the bail hearing. One other point just to make, having prosecuted a number of sex trafficking cases, is that one of the arguments that's often made by people like Maxwell, like in every trafficking case I've done, there have been women who are initially victims of sex trafficking. They themselves are compelled into prostitution. There's often force used, coercion. But then at some point, there are often women who become they start to work with the traffickers and they become enforcers. They start to go out and recruit young girls. You know, essentially they become part of the criminal operation and they themselves become sex traffickers. And in prostitution, generally, women are referred to as bottoms, which would be sort of like someone who was, you know, compelled into prostitution earlier, but then sort of becomes like the lead, may still be forced to engage in prostitution, but becomes sort of like the, you know, one of the agents of the traffickers. And here was interesting to me. I thought a lot about that dynamic. I don't think Maxwell can make those arguments because she was not underage when she was first with Epstein. She had a consensual relationship with him. There's no evidence, at least that we've seen so far, that she was compelled to engage in this kind of conduct or that she was initially herself was sexually assaulted. And so, you know, I'll be curious to see how this unfolds. But as I was thinking about the way that sex trafficking cases are often defended, particularly when it comes to women who are charged as part of the sex trafficking conspiracy, that defense feels to me like it will not be available or it will not be successful to Maxwell. But again, there are a lot of other defenses I think that they'll potentially make. And I've just been thinking a little bit about, you know, how they're going to frame this. And it's either going to be, I didn't know, which was her argument in these sort of depositions, or I was myself compelled into it. And so just sort of foreshadowing ahead to where this could possibly go.
We'll keep an eye on it. Can we mention another sort of peculiar personnel move at the Department of Justice, which would fly under the radar for most people?
So strange.
So remember, as a backdrop, as we discussed at great length, Jeff Berman, who was my successor at SDNY, was summarily removed. And the plan was to swap him out for the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, Jay Clayton, even though that person, Jay Clayton, fine securities lawyer, hadn't done any criminal cases, no litigation experience. Why would you do that when everyone's functioning sort of properly in their respective roles? We have another lower profile example of the same. The U.S. attorney who's been serving in the Eastern District of New York, Rich Donahue, who I know and I think is a good and smart lawyer, and you know, was a colleague. He was the chief of the criminal division when I was the United States attorney in SDNY. He was at EDNY, so I have no reason to think anything ill of him. But suddenly, it looks like the department wants to swap him out for the person who serves in a, you know, fairly prominent position in the Department of Justice, something known as the PADAG. That's the Principal Assistant Deputy Attorney General. So basically, the top staffer to the DAG, the person who Rod Rosenstein was, who is currently Jeff Rosen. It's a fine job, and it's an important job, and you know, there's a lot of traffic.
And a hard job.
It's a job that was held by our friend, Lisa Monaco, for a period of time. And usually you go to high places from there. And Rich Donahue was not confirmed by the Senate. He's another example of somebody who was appointed by the president or appointed by the Justice Department and then put into place permanently.
And then put into place by the judges,
By the court. And I mean no disparagement to high-ranking officials in Washington, but it is not ordinary for someone who is the either court-appointed or Senate-confirmed United States attorney in a big, important district like SDNY or EDNY or some of these other offices to go become a staffer in D.C. That's not something that happens.
It's a better job to be the U.S. attorney. You could say it. You're beating around the bush.
If anybody had ever offered that to me, I just leave it. I'm like, yeah, just why don't you just fire me?
You wouldn't have left your job for it. No. So I take that, and I think that's a really fair point. It is a very important job. It is an inside baseball job, and there is no question in my mind that there's got to be a need at DOJ. You know, Barr is the attorney general. The attorney general has just an enormous department with a huge number of priorities. Put Barr aside for a second. Like, the attorney general job is a huge job. The attorney general is also sort of the face of the department. And so if you think about public-facing events, the press conferences, or like dealing with the president in the White House, like that's often the attorney general. The deputy AG is often someone who has a lot of criminal experience as a prosecutor, who can work with the U.S. attorney's offices, who essentially runs like, and with the PADAG, who is their top deputy, essentially runs the day-to-day of the criminal sort of function of the department. Things do go up to the AG, but a lot of that is usually done by the DAG, the deputy attorney general. Here, the DAG can't do it. He doesn't have any background in it. He was a strange choice. I think you and I talked about it because, again, it's a really important function and part of the Department of Justice. So then they have essentially no one who has the respect of the U.S. attorneys, the respect of the criminal division, or sort of really just the expertise and understanding to be able to do it well. And so I think it's not a question in my mind that there's a significant need there, but it's also not a question in my mind that like that job is a step down in many ways from being U.S. attorney, where you have your own district, you get to run, you know, cases. They've been involved in, you know, they've done a lot of significant cases in Brooklyn, and I'm sure that he loves his job. And so you could tell me if I'm wrong, but I don't think they gave him a choice as to whether or not he would leave the Eastern District. The only other possibility would be if there was something politically afoot that Bill Barr was trying to step in and stop. There's no evidence of that.
I think the issue was less possibly the removal of Rich Donahue and more the insertion of a person who, again, I don't have evidence of this, but just there's a pattern and track record here. The insertion of somebody who has been in the main justice building for a while, reports to the DAG, but also obviously works closely with the attorney general. And maybe it's the case that they would perceive this person as being more malleable in a way that, you know, maybe other people have not been. And again, I'm saying that because there's been a practice, both with respect to the DC U.S. Attorney's Office and interventions in cases involving people who are close to the president, Roger Stone, Michael Flynn. You had the whole debacle of how they tried to remove Jeffrey Berman, clearly because they didn't like the way he was handling things and he was not so malleable. And against the backdrop of those examples, you have no choice but to wonder whether that's also happening in the Eastern District.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, it's also strange. And really, again, I think it's inside baseball, but it is one of those things that, you know, both you and I looked at and I was like, what is happening? And also, it frankly just shows whatever it is, it's a sign of how poorly managed the department is right now, whether it's being done for political influence or for other reasons, but it's really, really unusual.
The musical chairs is just odd. I mean, it would be a little bit different.
It's also bad for cases. It's bad for the institution. Yeah.
But in particular, the swap. I don't understand the penchant for the swap. Like, I guess we didn't choose properly in the first place. It turns out that the person in job A should be in job B and the person in job B should be in job A. That's, you don't see that a lot. Like, people either move up or they get removed. They're not swapped out, especially when the jobs are very different.
I mean, I would just throw one other thing on the table, which is that, you know, I don't know Donahue, but he's a career prosecutor, right? I mean, he looks like a serious career lawyer.
Yeah, he's a respected lawyer and prosecutor who we dealt with, and it was always professional and good.
Yeah, but he's now walking into a situation where, you know, we've talked about what Barr did with Roger Stone. We've talked about what Barr has done with Michael Flynn. We know that Barr is saying that the Durham report is coming, and that there may be criminal cases that they want to bring as it relates to that. I mean, he's walking into a swamp for sure. And I think a very, very difficult and problematic situation potentially. And so we'll have to see what happens to him, and does he get swapped out in a month, like, or does he leave, or does he you know, become part of that team? We'll have to wait and see. But it's odd, and it also sort of made me feel like they must like him and trust him for whatever reason it is, and think that he'll, you know, carry water consistent with how the Attorney General wants things to be done. Again, I don't know him, and I cast no aspersions other than to say, like, that is not a move that I think most decent U.S. attorneys would want to make. So, Preet, as we think a lot about the need for first responders and law enforcement and dealing with emergencies, we might have a little bit of a laughing challenge from Schweinfurt, Germany. You ready?
I'm ready.
I'm so ready. 2 weeks ago, 60 people were evacuated.
You're so good at this. I'm laughing already.
Are you on pins and needles?
Well, but I know what you're going to say.
You know where we're going.
You're not surprising me, so I think it's funny already.
So 2 weeks ago, 60 people were evacuated from a post office, which, by the way, I don't know if you had the same reaction I did, but I was like, why are people actually physically in post offices today? But
60.
But anyway, well,
can you say the name of the town again?
Schweinfurt.
Okay.
In Germany. okay. So 60 people were evacuated from a post office there after the post office received a suspicious package that postal workers believed was emitting poisonous gas.
So was this was terrorism? People thought it was terrorism.
Well, that's what they thought, right? So immediately they call emergency services. The smell was so bad that six of the postal workers were taken to the hospital and they were treated for nausea. There were six ambulances, five first responder cars, two emergency vehicles, and three different fire departments that all responded to the call. Then they do what they do in these cases. They think it could be a bomb. It could be anything. They probably suited up in their hazmat gear. And then they opened the package. And when they opened it, they discovered that the odor was not coming from a gas canister.
Wait a minute. So it was not terrorism. That's why we're laughing. Obviously, we knew that it wasn't.
It was not terrorism. The source of the smell was four Thai durian fruits sent as a gift to a 50-year-old Schweinfurt resident by his friend in Nuremberg. Often referred to as the king of fruit, durian smell and taste divide opinion. It's
have
supposed
you ever
to be the
had
smelliest
a durian fruit
in the world.
Have you ever had one?
I haven't had it. When our almost six-year-old, he'll be six on Friday, when he was like two, I think I've told you this, he was really into fruits and vegetables, not into eating them, but into cataloging them and knowing what they all were. And he could literally do the alphabet by fruits and vegetables. And we were pretty curious about durian because it is supposed to be the stinkiest fruit in the world. he had a friend in preschool whose dad loved it, was from Malaysia and loved it. And we went to Chinatown once to go on like a fruit and vegetable safari. And while there, we of course saw durian from a distance and we saw that it was made into like smoothies. I wanted to try it, but I could not convince him. So I have not tried it. I would try it.
It's funny how some people have described the durian fruit. For example, if people want to get a sense of what it tastes and smells like. Food writer Richard Sterling apparently once described the odor as, quote, turpentine and onions garnished with a gym sock.
<It's> so evocative.
And the late Anthony Bourdain, who we miss dearly, said that after eating a durian fruit, quote, your breath will smell as if you'd been French kissing your dead grandmother.
Now, I just want to say, people love it. Some people love it. And some say its creamy texture is similar to that, quote, of a cheesecake with a hint of almonds.
Whoa. That's very different.
It's like, I don't know. What do they say? Like, one man's something is another man's something else? I can't remember.
One man's gym sock is another man's durian fruit.
Is another man's cheesecake.
Yeah, I guess. Anyway, look, so I'm glad they took it seriously. I'm glad the first responders took it seriously. You take it all seriously. And I'm glad.
There is a happy ending, too, because the Schweinfurt resident got the package and has been enjoying the fruit.
Are we sure he's been enjoying it? I think we just need to say that so that the story has a happy ending.
And actually, Singapore has banned durians from mass transit because they're so smelly. And in case anyone's wondering, a lot of this information and the language we've used came from an article in The Guardian newspaper.
And have a good week. Happy birthday to your son. Don't eat any durian fruits.
Do not worry. There's no durian birthday cake coming.
And watch Hamilton.
Have a great week.
Watch Hamilton.
I will. I'll talk to you soon.
That's it for this week's Insider Podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior audio producer is David Tatasciore. And the cafe team is Matthew Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Calvin Lord, Noah Azulai, and Jeff Eisenman. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.